This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And I've had fun playing with technology this week. I actually got my beta version of Google Inbox. You actually have to request it, and so I've been.
So we're back to requesting things with Google.
Yeah. So you actually have to be invited to join. So I sent it in a request for Inbox to Google few weeks ago, and I got it this week. And it groups your emails according to categories automatically.
Is this the thing that where you pick all the different color icons you can sit next to each email?
No. It actually reads the emails, and it will take it, like, it will categorize them. Like, if I have an email that's relating to travel arrangements, it puts all my travel arrangements together.
Uh-huh.
Like hotel, airline, it recognizes them. Or if I'm going to make a payment on something, so if there's anything relating to payments, it puts together, and it automatically organizes them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can take and pin, you can pin a particular email, and then you can just look at all the pinned emails. It's actually a different way to organize the inbox instead of all of the threaded discussions. And so it's gotten fairly good reviews. I've been playing around with it. So you can request it by going to inbox@google.com, and you can make a request. And so you can just Google inbox it in Gmail.
Go figure.
Yeah, and then you can get an invite. And they're starting to broaden this thing out. And I've been playing with it. At first, I didn't think I would like it, but the more I'm playing with it, the more I think I like it in terms of just keeping it organized. And of course, there's a lot of security stuff going on, as there is every single week. This week we're going to feature Jordan Hubbard. He's one of the guys who, in the back of the open source movement, he's an open source evangelist, and he was co-founder of the Free BSD project, which was a port of BSD Unix to PCs, to the 386. To the 386 platform, and they made that open source. And by the way, that BSD distribution is what Apple based their operating system on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of open source history in what Jordan has done. He's an interesting story. But of course, it was a
giant
mailbag.
Huge.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Hold on. Well, that was the wrong one, but hang on one second here, because Mr. Big Voice will be fixed right this very instant.
Mr. Big Voice, would you please come in here, please, Mr. Big Voice?
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Okay, there he is.
Okay, here we go. At least you can help me carry this bag up to the counter, Mr. Big Voice.
Did you see him help you? No, he did not.
No, he didn't. He didn't. He's flashing his union card again. We got an email from Lynn in Ohio.
Uh-oh. Didn't she wrote us last week, didn't she?
No, there was somebody else from Ohio. There's a whole...
But she was in Florida or some other nonsense, right?
Yeah, we got... Dear Tech Talk, what is bandwidth? I heard people saying that they need more bandwidth to download movies faster. Okay, I guess Lynn is downloading movies and she wants to get faster speed downloads.
Great.
Okay, now what is bandwidth have to do with connection speed in megabits per second? I don't even understand that. I don't even know where the band is. I don't know where the width is. love the show, Lynn in Ohio. Okay, Lynn, this is a technical answer, but I think a lot of people are sort of confused about that. We just interchangeably use bandwidth for download speed. So basically, We do that. We call bandwidth in terms of bits per second, kilobits per second, megabits per second, gigabits per second download speed. But actually, the relationship goes back to signal processing. It turns out when you're sending digital information, you've got these spikes that you're sending. You're sending zeros and ones, and a one would be a spike, and then you go down to zero. And the sharper those spikes can be, the more bits you can send. Well, it turns out that many, many years ago, a guy by the name of Fourier discovered that you can actually form a particular wave shape by adding up a bunch of frequencies. And the more frequencies that you can use to add up, the more accurate the rendition is. So if you have a lot of frequencies available to you, you can make a very sharp spike in your ones and zeros sequence. If you have fewer frequencies available, it turns out that that sharp spike kind of broadens out, kind of has a width to it, and it becomes sort of curvatures. And as it broadens out, it means that you can send fewer and fewer bits per second. So the more frequencies you have available, the more that you can send. Now, you can do all these calculations, and there's a law called Hartley's law that says the digital data rate or the channel capacity is proportional to the bandwidth. In other words, the number of frequencies that are available to send the information. Now, here's the analogy that everybody's going to understand. Think of a piano.
Right.
Think of a piano. You've got all these keys on the piano, and if you use all the keys on the piano, that's the maximum bandwidth of the piano. The highest key is a very high frequency. The lowest key is a low frequency. And the difference in frequency between the high key and the low key is the bandwidth of the piano.
Okay.
So if you have all the keys available, you could write a very complicated symphony and communicate a lot of musical information. Now suppose you only have one key available.
That would be bad.
Can you imagine writing a symphony with one key?
People would walk out.
Yeah, people would walk out because there's very little information you could communicate. So the more keys that are available, the more interesting the symphony, the more information you could communicate. That's a very kind of a simple way to think of it. But bandwidth, and so bandwidth is directly proportional to the channel capacity. That was a great question, and a lot of people wonder about that, and then they, move on to something else. I have to say, they don't wonder about it too long.
Not for very long, no. It's like, oh, great, thanks.
That's right. So now you've had Fourier analysis in words with no equations.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Raymond in Florida. Dear Doc and Jim, I keep running into a situation where I see an email on my mobile phone, and then bingo, a little bit later, it's just gone. When I get home, it's there in my email program in Outlook. Having an email disappear on my cell phone doesn't do much good for me when I'm out and about. How can I get these emails to stay on my cell phone? Raymond in Florida. Well, Ray, this is actually a pretty common situation. It's got to do with configuration of your email client, and a lot of people don't quite understand. I'm going to explain it again. This is a common question we get here at Tech Talk. In the old days, most of your email systems were running post office protocol. They would basically download the email to your desktop. And since you only used your desktop to look at emails, that was fine. You download the emails to your desktop. And then as soon as you took them off the mail server, you'd delete them because you didn't want to leave them on the mail server because you don't want your mail server to run out of storage space. And in the old days, storage space was expensive. You also wanted to download your emails because in the old days, you always couldn't guarantee internet access. So if you download your emails, you've got your emails there even if the internet goes down. So that was called the Post Office Protocol, or POP3. Then we came out with a new protocol called IMAP. And the IMAP basically looks at an image of the emails that are on your server. It leaves them there. If you delete one from the image, it deletes it from the server. And so you never really download your emails to your device if you're using IMAP. So all the iPhones are set up using IMAP. So what's happening is you've got a desktop that checks your email you could set it to check it every 5 minutes, every 30 minutes if the client's on. And so it's just sitting there going away, checking the emails. It downloads a new email, and it just immediately deletes it from the server. So your phone is sitting there using IMAP, and it's gone. So you saw it. It's there. It is. And then your desktop client deleted it, and then it's gone from your IMAP image on your iPhone. So all you have to do is go to your desktop, And if you go to the account properties of that particular account that you're dealing with, and you go on the Windows, you go to the Advanced tab, there's something called Leave Copy of Message on the Server. And you click that. So then when your desktop downloads the email, it leaves it on the server, and it'll still be on your iPhone. And then if you want to delete it from your iPhone, it would delete on the servers. That's how I have my system set up. I've got everything set up on IMAP. I don't even use POP anymore because there's so much storage available on the net. I use everything with IMAP. But if you've got a POP account set up on your desktop, it's kind of complicated to convert from POP to IMAP. So just leave it as POP and just make that one small change. That was a very good question. We got an email from Jessica in Ashburn. Dear Doc and Jim, I was recently in the hospital and the use of cell phones was discouraged. Is there any evidence that cell phones can cause problems? Because I see many people secretly using their cell phone. Even the staff and doctors are off in the corner making cell phone calls.
Yeah.
So what are the facts on this?
Yeah, what's the facts, Jack?
Love the show. Jessica in Ashburn. Well, actually, Jessica, many hospitals do restrict cell phone usage by patients and visitors because of the possibility that cell phones could affect the functioning of medical equipment. Now, that's what they say. They also say you can't use cell phones on airplanes because the airplane might crash. And so that's also a suspect claim. Uh-huh. So but it depends who you ask and who's taking the data. So recently, the Mayo Clinic did a study, and they published it in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, and they found that cell phones posed little danger to functioning of hospital medical devices in a test. Now, they found out that there was only a small effect on 1.2% of the devices, and that's if you put the cell phone right up against it, and in no case did it affect the functionality of the machine, but they could detect an effect on the machine in 1.2% of the cases. So my feeling is that you could probably use your cell phone in your room or in the restroom without worrying about short-circuiting a patient's ventilator down the hall. Now, in a survey in 2004, this is what we all know, 64% of doctors confessed on leaving their cell phone switched on in high-risk areas.
Nice.
Such as operating theaters or high-dependency units. And so, you know, many hospitals are now relaxing the rules so that you can use them in the wards and corridors. But it's taking some time. In Canada, there was the first hospital in Quebec that lifted the restrictions on cell phones. That occurred in 2012. Now, I did a little checking. It's my understanding that Fairfax Hospital now allows cell phone usage in the room.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's like a recent development. Now, current phones cause a lot less interference. You see, in the first-gen and second-gen phones, they actually cause more interference because the signals, it was a different kind of signal processing. The signals were stronger, and they caused more interference. And also, the old equipment wasn't shielded as well.
Mm-hmm.
But now the new equipment's got much better shielding. The new generation of cell phones interfere much less, and so it's becoming less and less important. But if I were in a critical care or an intensive care area, since I don't think I'd use my cell phone, since it does have some small effect on some equipment, so... But just when you're in the hospital room, I don't think it matters that
probably
much.
Probably not. No, well, you know, when I had a stay back earlier in the year, and I sat there and used my iPad, not a problem.
Yeah, so. Nobody. I don't think anybody's going to really watch that. Now, there is an issue that phones actually do have a sanitation issue. They can carry germs.
Well, yeah, so there's that.
That's actually an issue. The second issue, which I hadn't thought of until recently, is the privacy issue. You could go and take pictures of people
That's a very good point.
You could take pictures of people in an unpleasant situation that they may not want to have posted to the web.
Did you hear the thing about Joan Rivers this week?
No.
About, you know, she went in for this medical procedure, and apparently while this was going on, the doctor that was in charge of this took a picture of her while she was under anesthesia.
Yeah, see, that's a privacy violation.
He thought she might want to have that. I don't know Joan Rivers very well, but I don't think she wanted to have that picture.
I don't think so. And there were cases where some emergency room personnel were actually posting pictures from the emergency room to Facebook. You can imagine that. So I think the privacy issue could be a valid point, I would think. Okay, let's see here. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we got an email from Reston in from Alex in Reston. We got an email from Alex in Reston. Dear Doc and Jim, I like to port files between my home computer and my work computer using a USB drive. Now, my employer recently blocked all USB ports. Now, this is really a problem for me. Why did they do this? And what are my options? Enjoy the show every Saturday, Alex and Reston. Well, you, Alex, I'm telling you, I think your employer was quite justified. USBs are a popular attack vector, as they like to say, for malware and spyware. And hence, many firms are blocking access to these ports. Now, for instance, there was recently discovered a security flaw in USB firmware. Once programmed, claim the researchers, there are a number of ways that the once harmless USB can act maliciously. For instance, the device can emulate a keyboard and issue commands on behalf of a logged-in user, for example, to filtrate files or install malware. Such malware, in turn, could infect controller chips or other USB devices connected to the computer. The device can also spoof a network card and change the computer's DNS settings to redirect traffic to malicious websites. A modified thumb drive or external hard drive can, when it detects that the computer is starting up, can boot a small virus which infects the computer's operating system prior to boot. So to prove the concept here, people discovered this vulnerability. To prove the concept, researchers Karsten Knoll and Jacob Lell created some code that they've dubbed bad USB, that they claim can turn a benign device evil. Bad USB tricks the target computer into believing that it's not a USB flash drive, but a keyboard. So when you plug the stick in, it rapidly sends a string in characters which look to the computer as though you've just your keyboard and you're just typing in input into the computer. Say if those commands open up a browser window and surf a web page complaining a zero-day exploit, you might find that your computer's been badly compromised just in the blink of an eye. Alternatively, the keyboard command sent by a malicious firmware could attempt to execute dangerous code on the USB stick's flash drive itself. What makes bad USB different is that they appear to have shown how the firmware of a regular USB stick can be subverted in this fashion, which makes it very hard to detect. Therefore, USB restriction is reasonable, and your options, you know, it's a reasonable thing. By the way, you know how they when they got this malware into the centrifuges in Iran, they used that through USBs.
Really?
Yeah. So that they basically sent malware to people that were around the centrifuge area, and they figured these guys are probably going to use a USB port, and it's a USB device. So they would infect the computer. They would put in a USB device to copy files to take it to work. And then it would infect the USB device. And when they plug it in inside of the secure area where the centrifuges were, it was then inside that network. And so that's actually how they penetrated it. So actually, DOD and all the defense folks have been keeping USBs out of all their properties for a good long while. Now these are your options. Now I've stopped carrying around USBs a long time ago.
I know you
ago.
Have.
You know, I don't really do that. I like to use the cloud. So I've synchronized my Dropbox account to my cell phone, to my home computer, to my work computer. And if you create a Dropbox account, you've got basically a Dropbox subdirectory. I just copy a file into my Dropbox subdirectory, and it shows up every place. So I now never carry a USBs. The other way I'll frequently do it, if I want to get a file home, I'll just send it to myself and attach it to an email, and it just shows up there. But of course, the email is limited to file size. You've got mm-hmm. some giant file, then you want to use Dropbox. But there are other areas here you can do cloud storage other than Dropbox. You can use Google Drive, Microsoft SkyDrive. You can use iCloud services. There are many options. So I think you should go to the cloud and not try to sneak a USB to work. But that was a great question, Alex.
And that was a fabulous mailbag, Doc.
Yeah, and so we love your emails. So email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll get back to you that week, or we'll just email you directly with the response.
Probably both.
Probably both.
Probably
yes.
Both. Hey, it's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. More about the show at techtalkonline.com. More about our sponsors at stratford.edu. Stand by. More coming up.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn by doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for...
Oh, so, okay, wow. Look at it this way. He's batting 500 today, which, yeah, that's Hall of Fame.
That is. That's very good, Mr. Big Voice. Today we're going to feature Jordan K. Hubbard. Jordan K. Hubbard is a longtime open source developer and open source evangelist, as they say.
Uh-huh.
He is co-founder of the free BSD project. That's BSD stands for Berkeley Software Distribution,
by the way. I have
my
finger on that button just in case. I didn't know what the BS part was for.
Berkeley software.
Oh, thank you very much.
So we give a lot of Berkeley software on this show.
That's piled high and deep.
That's right. We pile Berkeley software high and deep. Okay. Jordan Hubbard was born April 8th, 1963 in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Things could be worse.
It could be worse. He graduated from Drew College Preparatory in San Francisco in 1982, his parents said, you know, we're going to send Drew to this really upscale prep school.
Mm-hmm.
So he was going to get some hot dog college degree.
Hot dog college.
And so, you know, they were hoping he'd go to Stanford and be some big whiz. But then he graduated in 1982, and he said, you know, while he was going to school, he was a self-employed programmer. And, you know, he was making good money at that. So he said, you know, Mom, Dad, you know, this college thing, I can make money. I can make money programming. What do I need to take English and psychology and history for when I can just go out there and make money programming? So 1982, he was hired by Pacific Software, and he was writing programs for computer memory to use, you know, utilize computer memory. And he worked with them for about, you know, a couple of years. And then 1984, I think his mom was, you know, twisting his arm. She says, you know, Berkeley's not far from here. Why don't you just go to UC Berkeley? You know, you'd make your parents really happy. So he toyed around with college, and actually he got a job at Berkeley as principal programmer for UC Berkeley, which was, you know, a pretty good job, and he actually worked at that job for 4 years. However, he actually didn't graduate from college. He was...
Shocker.
So he was at Berkeley for 4 years. His mom said, you know, we'd like you to go to Berkeley for 4 years. So he was at Berkeley for four years.
That's the thing. He went to college for 4 years.
He went to college.
He was at
Berkeley as principal programmer for UC Berkeley.
That may be all they asked.
So this was the time, though, when Berkeley... Remember... AT&T had developed the Unix operating system, and because of antitrust rules back then, They were not allowed to be in telephony as well as computers at the same time. They had to pick one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So AT&T said, you know, we're just going to stick with telephony because that's what's bringing in the big bucks. So they gave away the Unix operating system, and a version of that Unix operating system was sent to Berkeley, and they repackaged it, and that was called the BSD, Unix BSD, Berkeley Software
Device.
It's a distribution, Berkeley Software Distribution, BSD. And then actually there's a small company that set up for Berkeley for distributing this software. And so this all came from AT&T. And so he was there at Berkeley during the time that they were going through all of this porting, creating, you know, a BSD Unix. So he was really in the Unix hotbed. And he probably thought, he says, you know, Mom and Dad, I'm here. I'm a hot dog Unix programmer here at Berkeley. You know, what do I need history and psychology for? He never did graduate from college, but he did graduate from high school. So that's a plus.
That's good.
So he stayed there for a while. And then in 1988, 4 years later, after he'd been at Berkeley for 4 years, he was hired as a senior engineer for Periphery Computer Systems, and he worked there for a few years. And then he was hired in 1992 as principal engineer by the Lotus Development Company, and he was responsible for sustaining engineering on Lotus 1-2-3. He also did the Unix ports for Lotus Word and Lotus Notes. So they were porting these things onto Unix machines, and because he had been working at Berkeley on Unix BSD Unix, and so he was familiar with that, and so he handled the Unix ports for those two Lotus packages, and so he said, you know, I'm doing pretty well, I'm moving up all these different companies. In 1993, he got involved with the Free BSD project. It all started in 1993, and it was an outgrowth of the unofficial 386 BSD patch kit, which was created by.
I have one of those.
You've got one of those, the 386 BSD patch kit. Yeah, it's. I know that you're really heavy into computers,
Use the patch a flat tire, but that didn't work.
That didn't work. So this patch kit was created by John Jordan Hubbard and Nate Williams and Rod Grimes. Now, it turned out that 386 BSD was a port of Unix BSD to the PC. And, of course, the Intel machines were the 386 series. So we ported this open-source software to the PC. And actually, 386 BSD was the first open-source operating system for an Intel machine. See, we always think Linux was the first open source, but no, Linux wasn't. It was actually 386 BSD, and Torvalds, who basically wrote Linux, said if he had known about 386 BSD and if 386 BSD had been in distribution, he wouldn't have written Linux because there wouldn't have been a need for it. So it turned out that 386 BSD was Bill Jalitz's operating system. Bill Jalitz, so Bill and his wife was a programmer. It was really Bill and Lynn. They programmed together. This was how they would. This was their recreation on the weekend. Bill and Lynn would sit around the house, and they'd work on this port of Unix BSD to a 386 machine, and they released the 386 BSD. They released it, and it was the first open support system. But the problem was they wanted to do it all themselves. I mean, you know, the idea of open source is that you let other people contribute.
Right.
So there were other people that wanted to accelerate the process, make it better. And this is when these three guys, Jordan Hubbard, Nate Williams, and Rod Grimes, they wrote a patch kit to sort of totally improve it and sort of accelerate the process. Well, Bill Jolietz, he said, you know, guys, I don't really want your help. I'm not going to approve this. I'm just going to keep doing it on myself because he didn't want to share the glory of this. So he was the opposite of Torvalds, who let everybody contribute. So they said okay. So they took their patch and they created a new version of a Unix port to a 386 machine, and they called it Free BSD. They named it in that. And that was a, and so they, and that, that was a name that was coined by David Greenman. And so, so they wrote this FreeSD port, and it turns out that Jordan wrote the initial FreeBSD ports collection. He wrote the package management system and sysinstall, and his friends wrote other things. They put it all together, and the FreeSD project was embraced by a company called Walnut CD-ROM, which was a, I mean, obviously they made CD-ROMs, and so, and it turned out these distributions were distributed on CD. So they said, well, why don't we make a FreeBSD CD and distribute it? And so Walnut Creek said, yeah, that's a great idea. And so they basically produced it and they shipped it out. And the first CD-ROM distribution was FreeBSD 1.0. It was released December of 1993. Now that release was based on the 4.3 BSD Lite, which was a tape from UC Berkeley, which was the original kind of Unix BSD, and they, that was called the N2 tape. And it also had many components which were as part which were part of the 386 BSD that had been written by Bill and Lynn as open source, and it included some additional code that they got from the Free Software Foundation. So and so they were going along pretty well, and then. Jordan said, you know, I'm going to have to earn some money here. This, I mean, this FreeSD,
it's great.
FreeBSD project is good. I'm really enjoying it.
But
you know, I don't have a job.
Or a house. Or
a house.
Or...
And so, you know, they started this open source, you know, foundation. And so he was hired as chief technical officer by Walnut Creek CD-ROM. It made sense. They hired him. And they said, "Okay, we're gonna become open source. We're gonna become the open source go-to place, and they're gonna build a business around it." Now, eventually, Walnut Creek CD-ROM merged with BSDI, another company that was getting obviously into BSD. And after they merged with BSDI, he was promoted, or his job changed, to VP of Engineering. Now, he served as co-founder and lead of the FreeBSD project from 1993 when it was started until 2002. Now, the reason he got out in 2002 is Apple hired him.
Ah, and that'd Apple, be a good reason.
And Apple said, we're not going to share our code with the open source community. So if you want to write code for Apple, you've got to get out of that thing. So he left it. So in July of 2001, Hubbard joined Apple Computer in the role of manager of the BSD technology group. Now, if you remember when Steve Jobs left Apple and he started Next Computers, and they wrote an operating system called Next Step.
Mm-hmm.
Next Step was based on BSD Unix. And it also used a lot of the FreeBSD code, but the thing is, they, you know, most of this free open source software, the guys write patch kits and all kinds of stuff. They don't make it really easy to use, and what Steve Jobs did, he made it really easy to use, so the user doesn't even know that they're using this open source core. So when Jobs was hired again by Apple, they bought Next. And they made the Next Step operating system, OS X, which, of course, is based on BSD. So it makes sense they would hire Jordan Hubbard as their BSD manager. And he led the development of many BSD and Unix technologies, which are at the core of the Mac operating system and iOS. And so he primarily focused on modernizing the Unix platform, improving security, improving performance and power efficiency. He didn't work on the interface, so he worked on the guts of it. And because that's why Macs have been actually, on average, more secure than Windows, because they're based on this open-source kernel coming out of Unix BSD. So he stayed with Apple for 12 years. And then on July 15th, 2013, he became Chief Technology Officer for XI Systems. Now, XI Systems is a company that was formed out of the historical company of the BSDI and Walnut Creek CD-ROM. So he's going back to his roots. But what he's going back to them in their roots, he said he got quite an education at Apple, you know, because the open source community doesn't make a finished product. You get this CD, you got to patch this, you got to patch that. It's a big, any open source software package is a project.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants to bring the Apple way to open source. So he's going to make, he wants to develop open source software that's really approachable, easy to use. It's got a great user interface. And so the trick that Apple did is they took open source core and they built a very polished user interface. And Apple's operating systems don't feel like toolkits. So he wants to bring that same look and feel to open source software. So here's the guy, Jordan K. Hubbard. You probably never heard of him. He's always been in the background. I don't necessarily think he made a lot of money unless he got, well, actually, he could have gotten stock options at Apple over that 12 years. He could have made some good money there. Mm-hmm. And he'd actually contributed a lot, and he never graduated from college. Now, maybe his mom, maybe he ought to go back and finish school to make his mom happy one of these days.
Here you are from Stratford University. Talking about a guy who didn't graduate from college.
I know.
What's wrong with that?
I don't know. But so that was in the day. That was in the mid-80s. That was in the mid-80s when probably the collegiate system really didn't have courses that captured the latest and greatest technology.
You had to go out and figure this out on your own.
Figure it out on your own. So there you go. As his mother called him, Jordan K. Hubbard, and the man behind... Free BSD.
Very good. Well, I hope you're paying attention because in just a moment, you're going to have your chance to parlay that information and knowledge into a free prize. Stand by for the pop quiz on Tech Talk Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM, HD2. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tysons Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airways. And of course, if it's a classroom, there must be an assessment, which is going to be, in our case, a pop quiz.
Right.
If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you'll win two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Jordan K. Hubbard. The man who never went to college.
Well, he did go to college. He never graduated.
He never graduated from college.
He spent 4 years
there. He spent 4 years at college, but never graduated. He was a long-time open source developer and evangelist, and he was co-founder of the Free BSD project. Now, this is the question. What does BSD stand for?
Okay, so this is the point where you tell me that I have to tell people to get us the answer. So
that's
if you're calling
right.
from west of Honolulu, Hawaii, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of San Francisco, California, 877-936-9333. Anywhere else on this global planet thing that we live on. It's 877-936-9333, as we like to call it, the wild card line. Or, Doc, I'm sure you have some other idea.
If you're calling from Kazakhstan, you can reach us on Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded directly to the studio.
I would highly suggest, though, using 877-936-9333. But that's just me.
That may not work from Kazakhstan, though.
I don't.
And they may also want to have good encryption on their call, which is what Skype will give.
I think most people in Kazakhstan, well, no, they're not asleep now. It's late afternoon
It's late now. Yeah, Kazakhstan was on my mind because we're teaming up with the university there in Kazakhstan. I was just meeting with them all day yesterday.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so it's a country that's fairly sparsely populated. It's just north of China, west of Mongolia.
Uh-huh.
But they are focused on education. So it's really great to talk to folks from Kazakhstan. Did you know that the subprime lenders can now disable your car? There's something that's been going on. And actually, I don't think the consumer knows it. There are GPS-based kill switches or starter interrupt devices that they can put on cars that they sell if they think that the person buying it has bad credit. I had no idea. And they put them on the car and they don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And some borrowers say their cars were disabled and they're only a few days behind on their payment, leaving them stranded in a dangerous neighborhood. Others say they were shut down while idling at a stoplight. And they couldn't get their kids to school. One woman in Nevada said her car was shut down while she was driving on the freeway.
You're kidding me. This is very unsafe.
I think it's unsafe. There was somebody who was carjacked, and they located the criminal because there was such a GPS device on the car.
This just happened here in Maryland.
That just happened.
Yeah.
And they were able to locate him because there was apparently he was a bad credit risk, and so this device was on his car, and it had GPS on it.
Amazing.
So I actually think there's probably some rights issue here, and that the consumer would have to agree to this.
Well, yeah. First of all, I think it's a privacy thing, don't you think? And secondly, there's the safety issue, which probably comes first.
I think there's a safety issue. So I think they're going to have to revisit that. It is actually an interesting idea because it gives the ability to sell a car to somebody who has a low probability of paying back, and they could still get the car.
Think about this. They have no idea where you are when they turn the car. If you could be driving on a freeway someplace and they shut the car off and you go out of control and people could die. This is nuts.
I know. It's dangerous. Okay. Yep. Big news.
Okay.
Microsoft Office is now free on the iPad.
No kidding.
Now, see, I downloaded Office from my iPad, and then, of course, the download was free. And I could read files, but if I'd want to edit the files, I had to subscribe to Office 365. So then I subscribed to Office 360. It was like $70 a year, and it's like $8 a month or something. So I subscribed to maybe it was only $5 a month because it's academic pricing, but it was something like that. So $60 a year, and so I subscribed to Office 365, so that I could edit documents on my iPad.
Sure.
What they did is that they now give you editing free.
Mm-hmm.
So you can download these Microsoft Office for the iPad, and it comes with editing, and it's free.
Neat.
So they said if you were one of the unlucky users that bought Office 365 because you wanted to edit this application, they'll give you a prorated refund.
That's pretty cool.
Which was actually pretty nice. Now you got to basically cancel your subscription. You have to have downloaded the application after March 27th. There are a few conditions, but I think Microsoft is doing a good job here. Now, if you want to go to some of the really super advanced editing features, you have to use Office 365. But I think it's very clever. They're sucking a lot of people into using Office, who might otherwise just use Apple software. So it's really a good idea. Well,
Doc.
Yes.
You're not finished with that, are you?
Yeah, I'm finished.
We have somebody waiting on the phone to talk to us, Doc.
Okay.
All right. Let us go first of all. Now,
About the contest.
You forgot. I'm glad I'm here.
I'm glad that there's a professional in the studio.
Sometimes I do actually. This would not be one of those moments. Sometimes I actually get it together. Let's get rid of that one and let's go to this.
That person was just humming on the line.
No, that was me pushing the wrong button again. I'm having big problems today. Zia, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Zia, welcome to the show. Dr. Schertz, if you would, please.
Yes, early in the show we talked about Jordan K. Hubbard, who's, of course, the founder of the Free BSD Project. What does BSD stand for?
Berkeley Software Distribution.
That is correct.
Zia, you are today's winner on the pop quiz. If you would, just hang on a second here, and we will let Sean take your information. Thanks for listening to the show today, and stay with us. This is indeed Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to us on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. And we shall be back in just a moment with more of Tech Talk Radio. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Google has analyzed phishing emails. This is phishing with a P-H-I-S.
Right.
This is where they try to trick you into giving them your username and password.
Mm-hmm.
According to a new study by Google, the most successful phishing websites capture data from 45% of the visitors.
Wow.
And that's actually quite amazing and a little bit troubling. They found that the majority of the hijackers operate out of China, the Ivory Coast in Africa, Malaysia, Nigeria, and South Africa. And these guys work fast. Once you give them the username and password to your account, 20% of the accounts are compromised within 30 minutes of having information phished. So this is what a phishing email looks like. You'll get this official-looking document, say, from Bank of America. And it will say something like, our security department is trying to verify that your Bank of America account is secure, and we need to have specific information from you to validate the security of your account. Would you please click on this link, log into your account, and then help us with this survey? So it looks very official. So you click on it, and you go to another web page. It looks like an official Bank of America
right.
website.
But there's always something a little different about
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you fill username and password, and they save your username and password, and that's emailed to somebody, and they immediately log into your account and take out all the money.
Right.
So the thing is, when you are asked to do anything, never go to the link which is on the email itself, because that link can be misdirected. It can look like it's going to a particular place, but actually the what's written in words looks like one thing, but the actual hyperlink underneath it goes to someplace else. So never go to the actual link on the. So if you say, well, I better check my Bank of America account, you just close the email and then you type in the actual URL of your Bank of America account and you check it out and then you see whether there's anything there. But never follow the link. And if you take the one precaution of never following a link on an email, you will never get caught in a phishing deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if, for instance, somebody in your family makes a mistake and they do it, What you want to immediately do is log on to that account and change the password, because chances are they haven't done anything for like 30 minutes. I mean, 20% are within 30 minutes, and I think, you know, so if you immediately go in and change the password, you're okay, because they then have the wrong password. Here's another privacy issue. Free apps that you put on your iPhone like to collect personal data.
No kidding.
Yeah, well, you know, the apps are free, but sure, there's the privacy cost. So when you install the app, you probably have this, like, terms and conditions, which really people never read, but and they just click OK. But these terms and conditions reveal that that you are voluntarily giving them a lot of data, such as your online activities, your location, your contact list, your text messages, and more. So researchers at the Carnegie Mellon University analyzed Google Play Store's top 100 apps, terms and conditions, and they found these 10 requested when they more information than they should have. Backgrounds, HD wallpaper, brightest flashlight, dictionary.com, Google Maps, horoscope, mousetrap, Pandora, and Shazam. Now, a Google Maps needs information about your location.
Yeah, sure.
Shazam needs access to the microphone because they're listening to music, so that makes sense. But you don't really need to have something about virtual pet getting private information, or something in a dictionary getting private information, or wallpaper getting private information. Yet that's what they do.
Flashlight doesn't need
flashlights. Flashlight is one of the worst, and there are a lot. There's a lot of malware built into flashlights.
No kidding.
So I would not download the flashlight apps, mm-hmm, because now the operating systems have built-in flashlights.
Exactly.
Now it turns out that Android doesn't have a per-app permission control. You see, in the Apple iPhone, you have per-app permission, so you can actually go in and you can actually fine-tune which apps have the right to what. And I periodically go in and do that. It's under privacy, and I check what permissions my apps have. But in the Android system, it's either all or none. So they used to have a per app permission. It was back in Android 4.4.2, but they removed it. They don't know why. So then what you've got to do then, because you can't do a per app control of the permissions, you really want to read the permissions and apps before you download it in the Google Play Store. Now, if you're wondering about which apps are really to be avoided, you can go to privacygrade.org, mm-hmm, privacygrade.org, and researchers from Carnegie Mellon have examined the permissions that apps need to know, and they give them a grade. So I'd only download grade A apps. I mean, unless, like, now I let Pandora have some rights to what I'm doing, because I like Pandora.
Yeah, but I do too.
So there's some that are okay, but you just should know what you're doing.
Doc, I think we're just going to keep it here. You got a lot to talk about.
I got so much stuff to talk about. Because it was a very newsy week.
It was.
Now, I thought this was interesting. I sort of got interested in time because we just had the time change.
Yeah.
Did you ever wonder why we say 10 o'clock?
I do now. Of course.
I mean, did you say, 10 o'clock? Well, of course it's 10 on the clock. Why don't you just say, what time is it? 10. But we say, no, 10 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
So this is where it came from. You see, in the simpler times, in the olden days, you could actually tell time in a number of ways. So, you know, there was solar time with a sundial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had clock time. Now, it turns out clocks divided the hours very evenly, whereas a solar time, the hour lengths varied somewhat depending on the season and all sorts of things like that. So clock time and sundial time were a little bit different. So if it was like 11 o'clock, you'd say, well, 11 o'clock, it's 11 on the clock,
mm-hmm,
or 11 on the sundial.
Right.
So that's what you would do, you know, so just to sort of, so it'd say, and it was actually 6 of the clock is what they would say. They'd say, well, it was 6 of the clock. And later, that got shortened to 6 o'clock, where of the was shortened to O, around the 16th or 17th century. In those centuries, it was common to just drop the O altogether and just say like 6 o'clock.
Now, sounds a little weird.
That sounds weird. I like the O. I like the O clock.
I do.
So the O became popular around the 18th century, and it was common to put an O in. It's like sort of slang words like Will-o'-the-Wisp was Will of the Wisp, stemming, mm-hmm, from a legend of the evil blacksmith named Will Smith with a wisp, which meant torch, Okay. Or how about Jack-o'-lantern?
Right.
It's like Jack of the lantern, which originally meant man of the lantern, because Jack was kind of the generic name for any man, so Jack-o'-lantern. So today, with clocks being everywhere, and hardly anybody tells time with a sundial anymore.
No, very few people do that.
But we still say, oh, clock.
Chock full of nuts.
Chock full of nuts. There you go. So there you go. Now, see, this is the kind of thing that really is a nice story at a cocktail party.
Yes.
See, now this Fourier analysis I did earlier, I'm telling you, that is not a good cocktail story.
This is like cocktail party sort of.
My advice is, do not go into Fourier analysis at a cocktail party.
You'll be alone.
Or you'll be sitting in the corner alone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's happened to me many times.
Has it really?
So over the years, I've learned to kind of keep it simple.
A good idea.
Okay. Have you ever noticed in an Apple ad that the time is always set to 9:41?
I have never noticed that, no.
You've never known?
No.
Every single Apple ad, whether it's an iPhone or an iPad, it's always 9:41.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Why? I'm sure you're about to tell me why this is.
That's right. Okay, and this is print ads, television, everything. It's always 9:41. Okay, it used to be 9:42, and then they changed it to 9:41. So we're gonna give the whole deal around here. The explanation is very simple. You see, it started with the way that Steve Jobs announced the first iPhone. See, what he did, he would always have the big reveal at the 40-minute point.
He'd
give all of his stuff, and he'd say, oh, by the way, there's just one more thing. And that would be the big reveal. And it was always timed to be at the 40-minute point. So they figured, okay, if he's going to introduce the big reveal at the 40 point, then probably he'll flash the picture on the screen
at 41.
At 9:40. Well, initially it was 9:42.
Uh-huh.
On the original iPhone, it was 9:42.
Uh-huh.
So in the beginning, this was in 2007, based on when they're going to reinvent the phone, 9:42 popped up. And so then they had 9:42 in the ads. But it turned out in 2010, all that changed. And they decided that it would only take a minute to get to the picture. So
mm-hmm.
they changed it for the iPad release to 9:41.
Interesting.
And so in 2010, when they released it, the big reveal was done at 9:41. And that was because, you see, they have to time it because they have a picture that's on the screen. And they want the picture to agree with
the right time.
Have the right time, you see?
Duh.
See, and so they did it at 9:41. And ever since then, Apple has shown 9:41 in all of their ads.
Now that is something you can take to a cocktail party.
That's another cocktail party.
And you will have
the
ladies will be hanging off your arms.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really think that's going to happen, Jim. But people will think, well, that's interesting, and it's certainly better than that stinking Fourier analysis.
Who's sitting over in the corner
that
now?
You talked about last time. Where else? Critical thinking, you know, just
or the space elevator.
Or the space elevator, yeah. Okay, here's another big message.
Uh-huh.
You can now deregister the iMessage online.
Okay.
See, it used to be, you know, you got iMessage. It's a way to send a text message through the iCloud,
mm-hmm.
and it's great when you're on Apple devices. But then what was happening? People were switching to an Android device,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't deregister iMessage, so all their friends with iPhones would send them a text message, and it would go to the iCloud server, and they wouldn't receive it. And there was no way for them to fix it unless they called up Apple Care. So now you can log on, you can deregister the iMessage, so it makes it easier to leave the Apple ecosystem.
Amazing.
Man, time just flew by. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and go to the Stratford University website, stratford.edu, and tell them that you heard about their programs on Tech Talk Radio.
If you tuned in late or would like to listen to the show in its entirety, once again, it will replay tomorrow at 4 o'clock. We'll see you next week with more Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500. 1400 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Of course, we have sports on the radio today. Navy football coming up against Georgia Southern at 2:35 this afternoon. Caps against the St. Louis Blues. The puck drops at 7:45. Sunny 45 today. Right now, it is 33 at 10 AM.